Angeles, California, here today with my most esteemed guest ever, John Spencer. John served 25 years in the U.S. Army and is now the chair of Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He is the co-director of the Urban Warfare Project and host of the Urban Warfare Project podcast. He's one of the world's leading experts on urban warfare, and it is a tremendous honor to be able to speak with him today. Before we start, I just want to make clear, defending Israel is not a cause du jour for me. It is my raison d'être. Forgive my French. I know my French sort of sucks, but you may be wondering, like, what business does a yoga teacher, the purveyor of peace, possibly have with a military expert whose very business is the business of war? The answer? Moral clarity and objective reality. Because when it comes to the complexities of war, particularly in the Middle East, facts matter. I know it's hard to listen to facts that go against your personal framework. But unless you have been to Israel dozens of times like I have, unless you have innumerable friends and family in Israel like I do, unless you have studied and scrutinized Israeli warfare like John has and know the soldiers of the IDF like he does, maybe, just maybe, there's something you could learn if you open your mind and open your heart today. And if you think that peace is as simple as Israel ceasing fire, I promise this will be a highly informative and enlightening discussion. That being said, welcome, John. It is an absolute honor to have you. Thank you for joining me, and thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about the conversation.
Yes, this will definitely be unique. My guess is you haven't had a lot of conversations with yoga instructors about the war. So my first question, and maybe it's so obvious in its simplicity, but honestly, I think it's very complex. Can you tell me what is the actual role of any legitimate military?
It's actually, I agree with you. It's a simple question with a lot of history and complexity to it. But by definition, a nation state's military is primarily there to defend the nation. Like the U.S. In the worst case scenario, in war to win. But it is. From the evolution of military state, nation state constructs is to defend okay. the survival of the nation.
And in that very definition lies a lot, I think, of the most important sort of understanding of what is going on in Israel. Can you redefine that or define that again specifically as applies to Israel today?
I'm sorry, Shen. I was hitting a button to get off my Wi-Fi. Can you ask me the question again?
Yes, your Wi-Fi definitely broke up, so I only heard parts of what you said, but I think the nation state, the military is set up to defend the nation. And so my question is, based on your experience and the time that you have spent in Israel, can you sort of restate that very statement, because it did get broken up, this time vis-a-vis specifically Israel and the Gaza war today?
Sure. So again, it gets complex. But again, the statement is, what is a military for? Primarily for the defense of the nation. In Israel, it's a little easier to define because it's called the Israeli Defense Force. It was created to defend the nation of Israel, which was acknowledged by the world, the Jewish people given a state, and then a nation created, a sovereign nation within all constructs. In Gaza, it's a it is defined the war as a defensive war. Israel was attacked by another entity on October 7th. It was invaded by another entity's military. And then it declared war in accordance with all modern constructs, to include the United Nations Charter, which, when it was developed, put into it very specifically, when can somebody start a war, when somebody can't. And Article 51 is about in self-defense. By sheer definition, you can absolutely retaliate when under attack without even having a UN vote or anything. Just let the UN know, I'm under attack, I'm defending myself. And that's what you have with the Israeli Defense Force in this war against Hamas in Gaza.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I speak all the time about the D in IDF. The fact is that Israel never starts wars. Every war that they have ever had, with one exception of the preemptive strike back in 67, because they were about to be attacked, it's always been defensive. And just going back to the concept of ceasefire, there was ceasefire on October 6th. I think that people don't understand that every time that there has been a war or a conflict, particularly when it involves the Palestinians, the Israelis have only responded. And John, maybe you can talk a little bit about the fact that Israel, usually when it responds, it's after tens of thousands of rockets have already been shot and deflected. What other nation, whether they had an Iron Dome or not, would wait as long as Israel does to even react to the aggressions of Hamas and other terrorists at its borders?
Yeah, we could do a whole show under that. Just the history of how many times Israel has been attacked, and why have I been going to Israel so many years, studying all its previous wars, where it has been attacked by multiple nations, literally from the day it was identified by the United Nations as the sovereign state of Israel, the home of the Jewish people. It was attacked by all Arab nations. I mean, just continuously on after that. The Yom Kippur War, the Six-Day War, everything, where no matter how vicious the attack, and we've seen even in this war on April 12th, when Iran, a sovereign nation, attacked Israel with overwhelming 300 ballistic and cruise missiles, drones, and then the world says, look, I know they attacked you, but you just need to let it go. And the same thing, as Israel was being attacked continuously from its border areas, like literally on its borders. And I think a lot of people who haven't been there don't understand the proximity to these attacks, that I can see the basically other territory and where the rockets are coming from all of our homes, or the IDF are in a war and the rockets are going over their heads towards their family members. A lot of times that escapes people that doesn't visit, but there has been, since Israel is a nation of, and they told me I could say this, geeks, they have developed ways to defend themselves despite this double standard of nation state status, as in no other nation would be forced to be under continuous attack. So Israel developed this capability, like the Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow 3, to shoot incoming missiles and rockets and mortars down. And it's created this rocket diplomacy, where for years everybody now says, well, I mean, I know they're attacking you, and any other nation that would warrant a war, like we can talk about in the north with Hezbollah, but the fact that they're attacking you, the world says, because you can shoot some of those down, like it's not a big deal. Like, no, by every definition of a nation state contract, when you're attacked, you can retaliate. But the world, to include in every war Israel's ever fought, and this leads to what Hamas's strategy is, the world steps in and says, look, I know you were attacked, but you need to stop. Right now, you need to stop, or I'm going to use force against, not the people attacking you, against you, to make you stop in this situation that is, it's a double standard because it's Israel, but, and we can talk about even the standards in this war are standards that nobody's ever followed. So it's a double, triple standard that doesn't exist. No other country would be forced to allow 100,000 of their civilians, like we have right now, be homeless while another enemy, not even Hamas, is attacking every day. And the world says, you know, yeah, we don't want an escalation. What do you mean escalation? They're attacking Israel viciously daily for over 9 months.
That's right. And it's, if for anybody who's been in this fight for a while, I mean, I've been in it for a few decades now. If you watch on October 7th, anybody from Ben Shapiro to Barry Weiss to, you know, the people who follow, they all said, listen, the world is going to have sympathy for us for a day, 2 days, maybe a week. It surprised no one and shocked no one that the world turned on Israel yet again after this most horrific massacre to occur in modern day in the Western world. What I think shocked us all, however, was that the turning on Israel did not take 2 weeks or a month. It took a minute. That within the day, there were people rioting all over the world against Israel, the victims of the massacre, which is absolutely unheard of and explains a lot about these double, or as you say, triple standards, because it is true that the standards that Israel is being held to do not exist. Not, you don't have to be a military expert to understand it. I'm confounded by people in the United Nations, in politics, and also reporters that don't even understand or seem to relate to the fact that the words coming out of their mouth have never come out of their mouths before in any other war context.
No, I mean, it's fact. I can give you lots of examples because I served for 25 years. I took part of my own deployments in wars. I spent 2 years in Iraq. But as a student of war, all wars, I can agree with you, and I can give you lots of examples where nobody has ever said that in the context of any war to any nation before. So you have to know that's because it's Israel and nobody else.
Yeah. From what I have read online, the U.S. war on terror, and in no way is this an indictment of the United States. I am a patriot to the core. But that we had 440,000 civilian casualties in our war on terror. And not a single person has ever talked about it, gone to the streets about it, worried about it, cared about it. And yet we take made up numbers from the Gaza Ministry of Health, aka Hamas itself. And every single person, from the president of the United States to the anchors to the United Nations, are screaming these numbers to the rooftops. Not only are they made up numbers, but they are irrelevant, if I am not mistaken, to the very concept of warfare.
Correct. I mean, there's three types of lies, lies, damn lies, and statistics. So I can make a number. If I'm biased, I can make a number, make you believe anything I want. And it's really hard to show people the context of war. War is hell. To quote, you know, some of our own generals, it is death and destruction. War has changed in the evolution. And there are plenty of things after World War II, the worst thing anybody's seen on our planet, to include the Holocaust, the worst thing that's ever happened in human history. There are things after World War II, as in the laws of war that were put in place to put limits on the brutality of war, where civilians have been paid the price for wars. But in a case like this, which is hard to make comparisons in the modern world because we have to compare Israel to other moral, law-abiding militaries, even defending themselves. So that group of people, the ones who actually follow every law of war that's ever been created, is very few. The U.S. military being one, and I'm not just saying that because I'm sure was in the U.S. military, and a lot of other Western countries. But we can't compare it to the Syrian civil war that has massacred over 300,000 people, 18 people a day, to Russia's war in Ukraine, Russia's war in Chechnya. We can't compare it against many other countries because they don't follow the law of war, and the world doesn't turn on them, and there's nobody in the streets protesting every day over real massacres like that are going on in Africa. It is ridiculous, but it is, people do fear what they don't understand. And it's like the world doesn't understand, even when you're doing everything humanly possible and everything anybody's ever figured out in war, how to protect civilians is what Israel's doing in Gaza. And I just got back less than 2 weeks ago from my third visit into Gaza since October 7th, watching the IDF, not just believing what I've seen on the news. I had to go there, meet with the commanders, see it in action. Israel is doing more to protect civilians than anybody in the history of war. And that escapes people, because even if people will listen to the history, like everything that's ever come, they can't marry that with the images that they see on TV, because we do have this new connectedness to see into wars like we never had before, let alone the misinformation and everything. But war is awful. It's, nobody wants war. But going back to where you started this off, is that in the history of humankind, wars have been necessary. And the idea of just letting, we call it appeasement, or there is evil people in this world, and they do rise to power and gain military capability, like we saw on October 7th, to do horrific things never seen in the modern history. And it takes force to make things better. So even in this idea of the oppressed and the oppressor that guides people's thinking, like, because they just don't know anything about war, they just want to see all the killing stop. They don't realize that that there is this evil on the earth, whether it's Hitler or now we have Hamas, who literally, first time in war, says they need as many of their population to die as possible. Like, not the Nazis, not the Japanese, right, not even ISIS, which weren't good guys, said that I need all of my population to die so I can achieve this higher fundamental religious ideal that my role in life is to destroy the nation of Israel and all the Jewish people. And if I do that, and if we all die, that I still achieve my goal. That's a really warped sense of evil that the world hasn't seen. I mean, to be honest, the world has never seen that.
Yeah, I think that it was Ben Shapiro who used the terms particular narcissism of the West, that we seem to think that everybody in the world has the same values that we do. And so when Hamas, like, this isn't just you who knows, like, telling the world this is what they're saying. It's not just me watching TikTok. This is Hamas that says flat out exactly their strategy is that they want civilian deaths, and also that they will commit as many 10/7s as they can over and over and over if they are left in power. But people, I think they cannot process that anybody would be this evil. So they're like, oh yeah, well, they're just saying that. And what's interesting about the double standard of what so much is expected of Israel and nothing is expected of Hamas, which breaks every single rule of war that there is that in so doing, it's acknowledging that Israel has instilled in it, quite honestly, a morality that they could even be held to that standard. We don't hold Hamas and terrorists to a standard because we don't commit them to any sort of morality. Now, you've explained on multiple podcasts that a nation's military reflects its society's values. And this is very much in line with what you're saying. Can you tell me, because you have been with the IDF, you have embedded with the IDF, you're doing your research there, what values have you observed in the IDF and more widely in Israeli society in your time there?
So when we go to the Israeli society, there's just so much there, as in the moral, and we say cultural aspects of acceptance. And if you understand the diversity of Israel and the sheer diversity of the nation is very unique, and because of the fact that the Jewish people have been persecuted all around the world, and the fact this was the home of Jewish people, and that is reflected in what the society is today, such diversity in religion, race, ethnicity. I mean, it is amazing. And that's reflected in the society, despite all the information about contrary to that. On the IDF itself, right? So we say these things about being a moral force, being in my world, it means also ethical. So a professional force, which is a military who has, of course, the law of war, but militaries reflect their society. So they put, because they've been given trust by their societies to use lethal force, which is a very, sometimes it escapes people. So they have an ethical framework which guides their behavior and holds people accountable if they're outside of that ethical framework. And fundamentally, like Western nations, and unlike other nations, one of their fundamental principles, and you see that reflected in everything they do, is to not target civilians and to protect civilians. Actually, lots of militaries don't understand. They're there to protect. Yes, they're there to protect their nation, but they're also protecting non-combatants in my term on it, and civilians. And you see that reflected in the actions the IDF are taking, despite, which gets to the kind of, you know, this contradiction people see in the image, like all the destruction and the fake numbers and the videos of legitimately harmed civilians, because Hamas is doing everything, because you said what Hamas says, but it's also what Hamas does. Like, sure. I don't care as much what the IDF say they're doing. I care about what they're actually doing, the acts that they're taking. Now, I can marry that with the history of war, the history of urban warfare, which is inherently destructive, and it can, how difficult it is, and everybody who's ever tried it, how difficult it can be. But when I'm embedded with the IDF, that underlying principle within their framework and their standards and their morals is they are trying to get to Hamas and will put themselves at risk, which people don't acknowledge. They'll put the IDF at risk, and they have so much in this war. Even though they have every right to remove the threat of Hamas, but they're putting themselves at risk to protect civilians, which is a kind of inherent in the framework of the law and the law of war and this moral ideal of what a military should do on the battlefield. It is to protect the civilians. And sometimes that means putting yourself at more risk in order to do that protection. And that's what Israel does.
Sure. And I, just to clarify, and I'm 99% sure I know the answer, but let's just ask it for the viewing audience. You are not Jewish, correct?
I'm not Jewish. I'm not Israeli. I have no affiliation.
Right. So you have no skin in the game. And that is very, very important. For me personally, as a Jewish woman who is also very, very deeply tied to the land of Israel, of course, what I say is never going to be purely objective. That's what's so unique when I listen to you speak, because you have this moral objectivity that I don't think I've ever seen in another commentator. I do want to insert that Jewish values, when I see what's going on in Israel, are very much... It's so bizarre to me when I see people who think that Jews are bloodthirsty baby killers. I mean, it actually makes me laugh. If only they could come to a Shabbat service where every other word is shalom, and all we pray for is peace, and not just for peace for our nation, but for all nations. And honestly, I can tell you that this is Israel. This is the IDF, and this is what we represent.
You said three kinds of lies. I would say, in my opinion, there are also like two types of war, right? There's war for the sake of war. I'll say, and I'm not an expert, what's going on with Ukraine, with Russia trying to invade and take over. And then there's war for the sake of peace. Even in the yogic texts, particularly in the Bhagavad Gita, they say, like, literally, God says to Arjuna that it is your moral obligation to go to war, even against your brother, if need be, to protect you and to protect your nation. Can you explain a little bit more? When is a nation morally obligated to go to war, and what are its moral actual obligations once in combat? I know that Israel has gone so far above and beyond those obligations, but at a base level, what is the moral obligation of the military at war?
So it's a tough question, because when you get to defining what is morality, you have these theories in the construct of war to include what we call just war theory, which is even St. Aquinas a long time ago saying that war is necessary at time for the greater good, as in to protect millions of people and what you see in Israel. So there is a definition of what is both just reason to start a war, like the defense of your nation and all of your people. And then there's also, but beyond that, there's the just execution of the war. So not only do you have to have a moral reason for starting a war, you have to have a moral execution of the war, as in how you fight the war also matters, which really gets to what you said before about, again, in embedding with the IDF, the ideal that, you know, everybody agrees October 7th was, well, most people, horrible, unjustified, no reason for it. And the way they did, so not only the reason they did the invasion, but what they did and how they did it, all unmoral, disgusting, unlawful, heinous. But people think that means the IDF acted out in revenge and in anger. And then they don't understand what a moral, a law-abiding military does. Even I, after 9/11, was sent into war. And yes, that's in our mind, but the actual execution of the war is not, I want to get these people for what they did. It's doing the mission that each military and individual units have been assigned, usually close with and destroy the enemy, not in some act of revenge, but in execution of a moral war, which is by definition part of this just war theory. And that's as much as you can explain on that, is why you start a war really matters. And we had this, all these other theories, and Thucydides a long time ago said nations start war for three reasons: fear, honor, and interest. Within interest, the survival of your nation is your fundamental vital interest. We, after World War II, after two world wars, implemented a framework, it's called the Global International Order, which further defines when a nation can start, or anybody can start, a war. And this is where you can get looking at other people's wars at this moment, like Russia, like Syria and others, and whether it's even a moral justification within the construct that we built, reason to be fighting a war, and how are you fighting it?
Sure. I guess I have a little bit of a chicken and an egg question then, as a follow-up to what you're saying, because when it comes to the morality of war, did you decide to study urban warfare because of what you saw was going on in Israel and the immorality of, or the unjustness of it, or did you decide to study urban warfare and in discovering what was going on in Israel, found the deep moral disequivalency, which probably isn't even a word, unequivalency, of what was going on there?
No, so it's actually interesting. We can call it the moral dilemma of urban warfare. I began studying urban warfare over a decade ago academically. You know, of course, I was deployed and I had my own urban battles, massive urban battles in urban areas where there is no harder place you can ask any military to fight at all, because of this tension of you need to get the civilians out of harm's way. The urban areas give you immense capability to defend. But the reason I started studying is because we were writing it into our books, avoid and bypass urban combat at all costs. Because nobody wants to fight in an urban area because of this moral dilemma of the fact that there is people there. There is the infrastructure that support people, that all this destruction happens. So there was a gap in globally in studying and preparing for these wars, or even knowing what happened in the previous ones, where no matter what, and by the sheer moral dilemma of where militaries who do the right thing are trying to avoid urban combat, those who are unmoral are trying to increase urban combat, like we saw with Hamas, Hamas built this entire environment for war. It weaponized its population to fight in this war, and built all of its infrastructure, 400 miles of tunnels underneath the urban areas, because it knows that Western societies, because war is a contest of wills, it's not just about the militaries, but Western societies want to avoid what we are seeing on our TVs more and more frequently, because of it puts the will of the people to even fight the war in tension. Because, like, well, I don't want to see all this innocent people being harmed, and the moral army doesn't want to either, but the actual other side needs it to achieve their goal. So I just started studying urban warfare, and then I got, okay, I had to go study Israel's war during, you know, the Second Intifada, during all its wars, you know, the Battle of Jenin, sure. Nablus, Suez City. That drove me to, why do I, have I been going to Israel for years?
Interesting. And to hear you say that you should avoid and bypass urban warfare at all costs, it really begs the question that everybody is accusing Israel of genocide. If Israel really wanted to do genocide, they could have actually avoided and bypassed the entire urban warfare at all costs by destroying Gaza in a minute with the military capabilities that they already have. Later, hopefully, I know we don't, I have so many questions for you that I could have you for the rest of my life, but I don't have you for the rest of my life. So we'll get back to some of these double standards, because I hope that everybody is aware of the ludicrousy of so many of these accusations that have been levied against Israel. But no soldier, no family of soldiers, not even the government and not even Netanyahu wants to see a single person die in this war, whether it's IDF or the citizens of Gaza. And I think that people really don't understand that, because it seems we are living in a completely Orwellian inversion of reality right now, where perhaps the most insidious example right now, I think, is the utter inability of people to distinguish between good and evil. Like, I like to put things in very simple terms. I grew up in the Star Wars generation, and I don't think the Star Wars generation ever ended. But how is it that the same people who could watch Luke Skywalker, the good guy, kill 100,000 stormtroopers, the bad guy, and cheer them on, and not understand that sometimes war is in fact the vehicle of goodness? In your mind, John, is there any confusion at all? And please be honest about which side in, and I'm speaking just about Gaza and Israel, because the whole Iranian proxy, Hezbollah, the whole thing is just too big and too complex. Is there any confusion which side stands for good and which one stands for evil in this war?
There's absolutely zero confusion with me. And again, as you said, like, why me? Why do I do these things? Because I do believe that there is good and evil. I am very pro-truth. I think there's confusion in the world, though, because of misinformation on thinking who is the good, the oppressed and the oppressor in this situation, to include people, which I think is really important. And I had this talk with a podcaster, Jordan Peterson, about this inherent, you know, people, one, don't want to spend the time to understand the war. They just want, they quickly make their decision on who is the oppressed and who is the oppressor. I mean, then they reflect their values on who they think are the oppressed, who they think that are the good people. Like, these are just freedom fighters. They're just resisting because of all the things that Israel has done to them. And they impose their values on evil, on the bad guys, like Hamas. Hamas is not a resistance force. It is not fighting for self-determination. It is not fighting or acting in any way for the benefit of their population. And no matter what they say and do, people are like, yeah, yeah, they're the good guys. They really just want peace and prosperity. And the entire history of who they are, everything they say, to include after October 7th, is the complete opposite of the values that people try to impose on them. They just want, you know, their own territory. They just want to live in free pasture. Like, that's not what they say. That's not what they've done for the last 15 years to their population. But there is a confusion in the world on who are the good guys and the bad guys. There's no confusion on anybody who actually understands anything in Israel or Palestine or the history of this or in this war. It's just, it is a very, this gets to the double standard, but it's very Orwellian, where we've reached a point because of this want of imposing our values on this evil, that everybody believes the opposite of truth, no matter the evidence presented to them. They just believe that those are the good guys, and they're being oppressed too, including this war. They're being oppressed. I think there is confusion. There's no confusion with me.
Yeah. I mean, but in what world would a social justice warrior, like these people who are singing Kumbaya in the streets, in what world, what could I do to them that would convince them or motivate them to go microwave a baby in front of its mother as they cut off her arm or breast or whatever it was? I mean, like, how can people not see that this evil is so complete and so, it's not even human. It's not even human. I don't even understand how anybody could not understand that there's zero equivalence between war and, I don't even know what to call it, atrocity, massacre. And in war, people are going to die. Has there ever been a war where people haven't died, John?
No, it's crazy to believe it. But this is the triples. This is why when I say Israel isn't being held to a double standard, Israel's being handled to a standard that doesn't exist. Like, to be honest, and I don't do politics, but the U.S. administration multiple times saying the correct number of civilian casualties in this war is zero. okay. There's never been a war in the history of humankind where civilians haven't died in the war. And despite in this war where Israel has acted in every way, which I think, like the definition of genocide, which is so ridiculous to use in the context of Israel's action, because it requires intent and actions. But in the Hamas's side, it's the intent, everything they've ever said, written down on their papers, but their actions even after October 7th. Yes, their actions on October 7th can't be forgotten. And the horrors of that day can't be forgotten. But everything they've done since then, right, is the acts that they're trying to get as many civilians as killed and get everybody in the world to believe a false number, or that that's not their fault. Every death that has happened in Gaza, exactly, has to be attributed to God, to Hamas.
Every single one. I agree completely. Intention absolutely matters. And it's funny that if the IDF were not such a moral military, then the human shield strategy that Hamas uses wouldn't even be effective as a tactic, because Israel would say, oh, great, we could kill all these people at once. Let's do it. The very fact that Hamas uses human shields is in deference to the understanding that only Israel cares about the citizens of Gaza. Hamas would just as soon throw them in front of a bomb, and Israel has literally called off operations if they have had particular intelligence knowing that there would be mass civilian casualties. And
it's not even, but it's just so you're clear, as a student of war, human shield strategy is unfortunately evolved, and most terrorist evil organizations on the planet use human shields, as in they put their civilians in front of them so you won't try to harm them. Hamas doesn't use human shields. It uses human sacrifice. It puts the civilians in front of them and says, please kill them. They're not doing it so you don't kill them. You're doing it so you kill the civilians so they achieve their political goals through the international condemnation. Everything they do is not to shield themselves. It's literally to get as many civilians as killed. And I can't get people to understand that's a difference. In this war, Hamas uses human shield strategy, but it's actually human sacrifice.
Sure. And I, going back just like 2 seconds from that last sentence, that Hamas, I have to give them credit for their propaganda, which is extraordinarily effective and has been. They've been using the same strategy for decades, and it works every time. Every time people fall for the same exact thing. So I have a question sort of on the propaganda front. Do you think, because as like a grassroots activist, I'm sure I see this differently than you do, but do you think that this war of words and propaganda is as vital as the war on the ground? Because what they are effectively doing is making Israel an isolated pariah state. Do you think that U.S. realistically will always have Israel's back? And how important is this war of words and social media?
So it's two big questions there. Number one is how important is the perception of the war? We call it information warfare. We try to help people understand what war is. War is politics. It is the pursuit of policy by other means. So in a war, you're seeking your strategic objectives. Both sides are. Israel's objective is very clear. Hamas's, people just don't understand. But it is a contest of will. Hamas's entire strategy is this war of the narratives, the will of the world to allow Israel to defend itself. Hamas has studied Israel's history as well as the Western societies very closely, and that's why this strategy has worked, and it has worked in spades during this war, despite what they did on October 7th. It's everybody falling into the Hamas trap, the Hamas strategy. But it's been there in wars in general from ancient time, but the use of what we're doing right now has amplified Hamas and other people's capability to influence the minds of the populations of the world to achieve their goals, which is to force Israel to stop. They stay in power. They keep building power to do what they say is their grand strategy, which is to destroy Israel and the death of all Jews. The second part of the question is, though, is in Israel's history, Israel has had to stand alone many times from the day it was created by the United Nations. You said, yes, Israel is a nation, home. And then the United Nations sat out while every Arab nation attacked Israel to make sure that wasn't possible. And Israel won. Israel finds a way. But one of the important things that was said at the beginning of this war, which war puts everything to the test. It puts Israel's military to the test. It puts Israel's allies to the test. Like, who are Israel's allies? And I do believe, despite disagreeing with many decisions that have been made, when the United States stood up during the first week and said Israel has had to stand alone before, it never will again. I do believe, and this is why I've always told people during this war, don't listen to what the especially the United States is saying, watch what they're doing.
Right.
So I believe that the U.S. will. I mean, the connections to the Jewish state of Israel and the United States in both of their developments has been, of course, not as strong in the past. It has developed something that I think is ironclad and longstanding, that beyond my personal beliefs, just by evidence of actions and connections, I do believe the United States, which is its strength, right? There's this old Chinese guy that a lot of people quote. He never existed, but people quote Sun Tzu a lot.
Said
that, yeah, he didn't exist. It was a collection of people writing. The actual the general of Sun Tzu never existed.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter. I love frameworks that help people understand whether it's the human behavior or war. And he said, if you want to defeat your enemy, there are 4 strategies. Number 1, defeat their strategy. So win without fighting. Number 2 is to attack their allies. And that's what Hamas has done, right? Israel can't stand alone. It's too small. Despite its huge advancements and power that its allies that are its number one strength. So the fact that Hamas is trying to attack Israel's relationship with not just the United States, but its relationship with Egypt, Jordan, many other countries is a valid war strategy. And then, you know, the next one is to defeat the enemy's military. Hamas never wanted to fight the idea. Its whole plan is just to wait out until the allies of Israel force it to stop. Well, and then lastly, Sun Tzu said the worst thing you can ever do is attack a besieged city, which for the reasons of that. But I do believe that the United States will stand with Israel. And they said this over and over again, that Israel, we will defend Israel's existence, period, always. And we've done that through actions, like when Iran attacked Israel, which was ridiculous. And through support of Israel. Now, the politics of war, when you're telling Israel, like, look, I agree, but you got to find a different way. Yeah. And I'm the guy saying, oh, there's a different way, like you said, which is the question that the United, you know, the current, because of the the United States government, militaries won't, although they have, say, okay, what would you do?
Right.
Right, that double standard. What would the United States do? If anything, even vaguely familiar to the attributes of October 7th, an invasion on a border, rockets into all the urban areas, massacre, rape, beheading, burning, taking all the civilians back in enemy. What would the United States do? I can say as a student of U.S. military history is that it would look a lot different than what Israel did. It would be use of overwhelming military power and force to achieve our goals as quick as possible. Because this is the other thing, is that people, you know, the path of horrible thing is led along good intentions, right?
That's
people
right.
believe that if Israel just didn't bomb as much, there would be a lot less civilian death. If Israel just did it like a different way, there would be less destruction and civilian death. That's not true.
Right.
The world, all these people believing what they believe, have caused more suffering in Gaza because they have prolonged the war. They
right.
have allowed Hamas to continue
sure.
to make the people of Palestine suffer.
Sure. And also, they give them their full strategy before going in order to protect civilians. There's that. So I'm going to ask a question that you don't have to answer.
Okay.
It's about Biden. Because it's been, I don't know that there's ever been a war that doesn't involve Israel where a country supports both sides. It's been super disconcerting to see how I know what he's doing, and he's mostly been supportive, but the words that he says have been deeply undermining, I believe, at the same time. And maybe this is my own personal ignorance, but Biden is not just the president, but as president, he is also commander in chief, which means that he has not just political, but also military obligations to this nation. As he is slow walking the military aid that Israel needs to defend itself and fast talking against it at the same time. You don't have to answer this. Do you feel like he is upholding his obligations as commander in chief in protecting U.S. interests abroad and with one of our most strategic allies?
Okay, you're right. I won't answer that question. I will say, though, more related to that question, I understand the genesis of some of the positions, like the use of large diameter munitions, like the 2,000-pound bomb. I know where that comes from because I have worked in this very topic for 10 years plus. I know the vast community of human rights activists that think there should be no urban combat. And one of their strategies, or they think there should be no war at all, like no war ever, like they're anti-war, which is fine. But I know one of their strategy has been to vilify like bombs. Like, okay, you can fight your war. You can even have it in the urban area, but just don't use any bombs because they're so disconnected from the world of reality of what is the realm of possible. That leads into this position of how dare you use a 2,000-pound bomb to hit a guy in a tunnel in a bunker, despite the complete history of its use by moral law-abiding forces. How dare you use that weapon against that enemy in that environment? I know where the ideal comes from. So when I saw that campaign, it wasn't a surprise to me.
Sure.
Because it's literally our administration and our leadership being given false information on the history of the use or on the realm of what is possible if you take that tool away from anybody, to include the United States. And I've written that in the past.
Well, I hope the United States, that the president who's been dealing with Israel for decades and knew Golden way back when, knows the difference. But we're going to go ahead, put that aside. I have to ask as well, do you feel like the U.S. government has done enough or everything it can to secure the release of our hostages, including the 8 U.S. hostages that are still in captivity?
I'll say this, because that one you're hitting at my value system, with no affiliation to any institution or anything. 100%, a lot more could have been done to bring American hostages home.
I'd like to see all of the hostages brought home, of course, but I think that simply threatening Qatar that U.S. would take away its base, or Egypt, stop giving money to Egypt, to Jordan. There are things that we could have done to procure this release immediately. Why that hasn't been done, I don't even know if that is, an issue of the military at all. And when it comes to all these double standards, it's hard to imagine any reason other than anti-Semitism that could possibly be behind what you would call, again, this triple standard. Is there any other idea besides the fact, like, even we could say, oh, it's because the media is so present and shows all these this dramatic footage, but the fact that they're present, the fact that they're doing this dramatic footage, and the fact that they're always positioning everything against Israel, again, like, why Israel, this tiny little country that is a tiny fraction of a percentage of the size of the Arab and Muslim world, smaller than the state of New Jersey, and yet the world is completely obsessed with them. Do you, from your experience and from your studies, can you see any reason other than anti-Semitism and pure hatred that might be at the base of this triple standard?
I've come to realize, as objectively as I can, that there can be no other definition than the deep-seated anti-Semitism and anti-Israel underpinning of all of it, because it just doesn't make sense to me. Like, things like, what is your civilian to combatant ratio? That's never been asked in any war in the history of war. Right. But that being, through all these different strategies, many people don't even understand that that's never been present. So you got to take apart just the anti-war, the protective civilian aspect to it, and say, like, that's a data point that it's never been asked, and it's only being asked of Israel. So you have to, I've come to realize, again, not Jewish, not Israeli, that is very unique, and it has to be wrapped in decades and decades of strategies to put this seed of anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, everything they do is evil and bad, into rational thought when it is irrational. And when I can show you, like, nobody's ever asked that question, nobody's ever imposed these restrictions, it's never been present. So just as a rational, critical thinker, there's definitely a foundation to that.
Sure. John, I really want to respect your time, although I really don't, because I would love to continue this conversation. If I may just ask one last question on closing, and then I will let you get back to your very busy life. For me personally, and I think for most Jews in the world at least, there's something that's very, very sickening about the fact that terrorism has basically become a cause célèbre in the Western world. It's confounding. It hurts the head. And I feel like these social justice warriors that have become so blinded by and drunk on the Kool-Aid of their own anti-Semitism. And I understand that some of it is latent, like, they don't even realize how consumed with hatred they've become. In your opinion, how can we turn the ship around before our society consumes itself?
There's no easy answer to that, to be honest. Israel is facing multiple existential threats simultaneously, while trying to maintain so many aspects of reestablishing. I mean, October 7th changed the world. It changed Israel. It will change everything. But right now, there are immediate existential threats that are attacking Israel. How to turn the ship around is a separate conversation. For me, how do we get towards a next phase of this operation where, I do think, and focused on what we've been talking about, the number one, I can't tell you what the future will hold. I know that Israel will be there. It's not going away. It will be there. And it has many allies. And the fact that it has created all these normalized relationships with people that used to want to eradicate it from the face of the earth and acted in that way is very positive. So it's not all negative, but I can say with very strong objective certainty, the only path towards peace for even the Palestinian people in Gaza is the removal of that cancer of Hamas, not as an ideology. That's step three. As step one is to remove that evil entity from power over the Gazan people in Gaza and their military capability to wage war against Israel. That's step one. And that is the surest path to peace for everything getting better. And the surest path to just continuing the cycle of violence is if Israel is forced to allow Hamas a victory in this war.
Yeah. John, I can't thank you enough. When I see the people that you have been talking to, I am honored beyond belief that you took the time to talk with me and to speak with my audience. And thank you so much. As we say in the old country, namaste. And are there any closing thoughts that you would like to close with before we go?
No, and thanks for the invitation. Really enjoyed the conversation. It's a very important topic. And for all my friends out there, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much for everyone who tuned in as well. I hope that you will look up John Spencer. Also, you could find him as Spencer Guard on Twitter, on Instagram, and obviously on his Urban Warfare podcast. I'll also put it in the show notes. I hope that you'll follow him. I'm particularly fond of the conversation that he had with Sam Harris, with Jordan Peterson, as you referenced, because you both have this beautiful objectivity when it comes to morality, and also a beautiful talk fairly recently with Caroline Glick that I think all three of those really add to this conversation very deeply. Thank you again, John, and it would be amazing if we could talk again someday.
Thank you so much.